This is a Pinball News production.
Okay, everybody hear me? It's okay? All right, good. Okay, we're going to talk about the evolution of games in the 30s and the people behind it. I'll assume people don't know that much. If you know a lot about 30s games, maybe this will be kind of boring. I hope not, but we'll just sort of give you the overview from the high level because you could talk for hours about this stuff. So just to start, my interests, I collect and fix up games from all eras. I built a game and brought it here a couple of years ago. I've done a lot of research the last 10 or 12 years on 1930s and 1940s history. I've created pinball ad catalogs, so far covering ads for games from 1931 to 36. And volume 3 I've got for sale here at the show. I also did a short presentation on pinball in World War II and conversion games. And I know parts of the story, but there are other people who know a lot more than me, and this is just my perspective on what I've seen and how I think the game evolved. So I'll talk about features, evolution, and timelines, cultural tie-ins, because the 1930s was an interesting time period, and we kind of see a little bit where, you know, pinball fits in a bit. Other coin-op amusement trends that were going on at that time, the people involved, and finally we'll talk about Mr. X. So just briefly in the beginning, we start out with billiards, which we got bagatelle, which we got pinball, and there's a long, slow evolution from the 1600s to the 1900s. For this presentation, we're going to focus on what I call the start as a commercially sustainable industry in 1931. There were lots of fits and starts before that. Necessity for money was the mother of invention in this time frame, and I think that's kind of what kicked it off. It was the right game at the right time. And for all that early history and the history through 1936, Dick Bouchel's got two encyclopedias of pinball, volumes 1 and 2. They're really in-depth, and there's lots of magic stuff in there. So I recommend that you buy and read those books. So we'll go through sort of year by year here and see how the game evolved. In 1931 and 32, the games were principally tabletop and made out of wood. They had holes and pins, the pins being nails or brads, sometimes wood. No electricity, no bells, kickers, bumpers, or lights. Typically 10 balls for 5 cents or 7 for a penny. And it was a garage industry. There was a low barrier to entry. It really didn't take much. If you knew how to hammer together a cabinet and could put some wood on a table, that's all it really took to get going in this industry. And we saw hundreds of makers coming out with games in that period. And there weren't a lot of lawyers around then either, so it wasn't so hard to just copy somebody else's design if they were making money. Some of the games, prototypical games from that period, are Ballyhoo and Baffle Ball. I'm sure you've all seen these. Ballyhoo's, I think you'd call it a typical pattern of the time, just pins and holes, and arranged in a certain order, and a lot of games followed exactly that pattern. There were some deviations, but that was pretty standard. Baffle Ball from Gottlieb, very popular game, had the trap holes, but otherwise another popular game. Those are probably the two most popular games from that period. There was a sort of an oddball deviation in middle of 1932 with the so-called circle square games. On the left, we see Bally Round from Bally and Daisy from Pio in Rochester, New York. These games were short-lived. They look kind of cool because they're round. You shoot the ball and it spins around in a circle, but this format didn't last very long. So there was a handful of games created like that, but it was very short-lived. Didn't turn out to be that popular. Moving on to 1933, we see the games are sprouting legs or stands, and they're a lot more popular than they were. We see more castings and mechanisms on the playfield. The tilt device from Harry Williams, or also called the stool pigeon, it was conceived. Scoring was still mechanical. You had to add up your own scores. Back then, people knew how to add because that was taught in school, and they didn't rely on calculators. So it wasn't really as onerous as it sounds. Electricity was starting to come in. I think the first game that used electricity for any purpose was ABT's Auto Count, and they used that just for running a little ticket printer to print your scores on. That was in late 1933. Bally came out with electricity for their rocket payout game, but it had a lot of gremlins and problems, and it really didn't wasn't really reliable until 1934 with the improved rocket game. But there you see the first use of electricity for payouts. And popular games from this year, Airway, Rockola's World's Fair Jigsaw, Big Broadcast. And here's just a flyer for the Bally Airway. You can see at the bottom, you have a really nice casting across the bottom, and the scores would appear there, but you still had to add them up. Big Broadcast, an early 1933 Gottlieb game. It had a, I think that was the first Gottlieb game that had a tilt mechanism on it. Elaborate flyer, and you can see they had junior and senior versions. They different games for different locations, slightly different sizes, but with the same general design. Okay, 1934, Harry Williams comes along and starts to employ power or electricity for novel purposes. We finally see electricity being used for playfield features. Contact from Pacific Amusement, or PAMCO, out in 1934 had both bells and kickers, like a kickout hole powered by solenoids. Very popular game. That game was built in California, and also in Chicago under contract by Stoner and others. And I think one of Russ Jensen's interviews with Harry Williams, they said he went to the Stoner factory and, you know, they're creating the so-called aristocrat line of games, custom built. And you could see why they're custom built, because they weren't using jigs. They were sort of hammering the nails in on each game individually. And they weren't exactly always registering in the same places. We see automatic payout games appearing, like especially at the improved rocket. By the end of the year, the game started to have lights on the playfield. I think Bally's Skyscraper might have been the first, using that for illumination. Rockola was creating some of their mechanical beauties, like the World Series game and Army-Navy. You see Army-Navy games going for over $5,000. World Series, a beautiful game. They made, I think, like 70,000 of those, and I think that's probably the game that's probably survived the most, just based on the number of games I see traded. World Series is way ahead of any other game out there. And these are strictly mechanical, no electricity. Other games from the year, to point out, maybe Red Arrow from Bally, Duval's American Beauty, Genko's Pontiac, and PAMCO's Major League, another baseball-themed game. So we see a Red Arrow, a one-ball payout game on the left, and Major League. You can see it was a popular for baseball games. It was popular to have four holes arranged like a baseball diamond, popular with the public. Baseball and football themes always a popular theme. Moving into the middle of the decade, 1935, I guess I'd call that the year of lights. Putting the, you know, the small 6-volt bulbs on the games was prevalent. Back boxes coming along. Before, the games are pretty well flat. Now they're starting to sprout marquees or back boxes. Some of them with lighting, some of them just strictly with instructions, but there to catch the player's eyes. Payout games, the number of payout games that people are building. Cash payout games are growing. And we also see ticket dispensers and check separators appearing. Jay knows about check separators on his quest to find out and get that documented. Have you got photos yet, Jay? No. So we're still looking. If people have photos of games with check separators, Jay from IPDB wants to see them. So talk to him. We know in theory how they work, but we want some nice photos. Check separator is like a token with a hole in it, and as it's going into the game, the mechanism detects the hole and puts it one way. If it's cash, it goes a different way, so they can separate them out.
And I think Wayne Nyans told me once that the one he remembered didn't have a pin that went through the coin.
Right, it didn't necessarily have to. Right, Right. There's like an escalator, but it knows how to detect the tokens from the coins and keep the, you know, the management of the money in place. 1935, we also see mains power coming along versus batteries. All the early electrical games were powered by, you know, the large 6-volt cells, and they're of course prone to leakage, and they take up a lot of space, and they wear out. Or if there's a, you know, a problem, and the lights stay on, it drains the batteries. So we see the mains power coming in, but you know, back then, you know, you can't assume that every place is wired with a 100 outlets along the wall. You know, they might have to install a game and run the wire up to the ceiling off of a lamp, and you know, you got a 50-50 chance of a fire. But it was kind of like that. So we see games like Criss-Cross-A-Light, Neon-Tact, Tick-A-Light. There's a lot of A-Light games. These are just, you know, they want to really focus on the fact that these games have illumination, sometimes for just general illumination and sometimes for features. Like Duval's Spotlight had lights that would flash back and forth when contacts were hit. Here we just see some of the games. Tick-A-Light. It's a game I own. On the left, that's a stoner game. You see it has a ticket dispenser at the front, kind of like a redemption game would be now. It had lights on the play field and some interesting action. And you can see the small back box. It's just, there's no illumination there, I don't believe. It's just a sign, but it attracts your attention. And if anybody's been buying 30s games, you'll probably note that if it came with a marquee, it's probably missing. They're typically got lost in the shuffle over the years. Criss-Cross the light in the middle, that'd be a typical light-up game. You can see the back box is kind of short and stubby, but it's illuminated from behind. It's probably silkscreen dart, and they're just starting to, you know, utilize that to show you, keep you informed on your progress in the game. Neon Tact is kind of a unique game on the right from PAMCO because it's all done with neon. That's neon that lights up in the back, and there's neon arcs in the playfield. If you're here last year, I think Clay Harrell was at Richard Conger's place in California and showed nice video of that game in operation. Maybe there's a YouTube video or something of it. But that was kind of a neat game. John's always looking for neon games. So sell one to John if you find one. Okay, in 1936... the mains power is winning over batteries. People are getting fed up with leaky batteries and the problems. And the games are also, especially if they're payout games, they require a lot more current, and they can, you know, they're just draining the batteries faster. So now it's more important to plug into the wall. There's companies sprouting up to sell, you know, adapto packs or electro packs, which are, you know, just transformers to convert AC power out of the wall to DC. Or some areas of the country would still be running on DC power, and it would just be like a step-down transformer. But the games are now mostly powered by mains power. And I know Wayne Nyans, hi Wayne, he worked on, I think a lot of the work he did initially was converting games and working on electro packs for the games for Western back then when he first started out. 1936 was the peak year for payout, cash payout games. I think probably the legal ramifications started to, you know, affect the industry, and they slowly over the 30s they started to, the number of cash payout games started to decline. There's always a period when you do something new that before the society and the police and the legal authorities kind of catch on to what's going on. But 1936 was probably the peak year in terms of number of games produced. We see the back boxes are getting bigger, and there's even a little bit of animation there. They're still not full-sized. A lot of games are still produced that don't have a back box at all, but now we've got some. They're just getting there, and they're just creeping up in size as they realize the value of having that additional space for advertising and communicating with the customer. Mills created a lot of classic games that year, Tycoon, McCoy, Railroad, three of them. Elaborate castings, you know, they're kind of almost like slot machines with a slot machine type crank handle on the side. nice cabinets, really, really nicely done up games, and very collectible today. And you see some of the other titles from the year: Hialeah, Derby Day, Madcap, Turf Champs, Races, Policy, Flying High. A lot of horse racing themes. Horse racing, easy to implement for gambling purposes. It fits in well on other themes as well. So we see here the Stoner Turf Champs on the left. That's really nice game. I think it's probably the nicest game that Stoner ever came out with. See big, beautiful castings at the bottom. And on the side, there's a silk screen glass with odds. On the right, profile of a Mills Railroad. You've got the multi-coin, seven-coin head there, so you can bet on seven different spots, put a nickel in each slot so they can take a lot of money. You got the crank handle. The side of the cabinet is made to look like an actual railroad engine, and you don't normally see that much effort and detail put into games like that. Okay, 1937, we see at the start of the year, Bally comes out with their game called Bumper, and that kind of changes the playfield landscape. It's kind of like a 90-degree turn in the way things are going, because now we don't have kickers and pins and holes. Now we've got these springy bumpers, and it kind of took off. And you'll notice a lot of games in 1937. Suddenly, games are all full of bumpers, and it's like they just forgot about a lot of the other stuff they'd been doing for the last 5 years. And the bumpers, you know, there's no standardization, so although it's typically a spring bumper, there are other, you know, they look a lot, some of them look a lot different. There was a lot of different techniques tried to get a bit of bounciness in the ball action. We see the back boxes are still growing, and there's light animation employed, you know, where there's a sequence driven off a unit that, you know, the lights flash in a certain way, and it makes it look like there's something happening in animated action. We see playfields made out of metal. Not too many, but there were some. I think the purpose of that was, to have a very fast surface, a slick surface to increase the ball action. But in some cases, the metal of the playfield is actually used as part of the electrical circuit to close a switch, which is kind of an odd way to do things, but it was done. We also see some early use of electronics in games. You could say it's 40 years ahead of its time, just because electronics in pinball games really didn't take hold, as we know, until the mid-70s, but there was at least optical electronics employed to detect where the ball was. Games like Fireball, Magic Lamp, and Crossline are examples from that year. We got some pictures here. Firstly, we got bumper. You can see the format of the bumper up top. The ball hits the spring. The contact goes through the play field and closes a switch and registers a score, and the ball bounces around, and you've got an army of bumpers on the play field, and the score is registered. Big hit of the day. They gave Ray Maloney a bumper trophy, which was actually molded in the shape of his bumper for coming up with a new innovation. Here we see the Keeney Fireball, which has the optical electronics in it. There's like five beams of light on the playfield. It kind of looks like a letter M. I don't know if you can tell on the right. The ball trips the path and registers a score. You'll see for bumper, they advertise no pins, no pockets, something new. You can go forward, and you see this one says no holes, no bumpers. So you got two schools of thought. On the one hand, you've got they're expanding on the use of bumpers as a new scoring feature, but after the market's flooded with so many bumper games, they're expanding the use of non-bumper games. So things changed rapidly back then. In 1938, we see use of electromagnets under the playfield. Games like Lightning, Buttons, Paramount, Spinner, Thunderbolt, these are exhibit and Bally games. At right, that photo, that's from the Bally Paramount, where they have like a captive ball, and the electromagnets will cause the ball to spin around wildly and registering over the switches to score, which is kind of nice. We see the first pop bumper. The pop bumper was invented in 1938, not 1948. It was invented by Wendell Bartelt of Stoner, and it was on Zeta. I own a Zeta game. It uses like the 48 action where, as the solenoid pulls down, the spring expands and pushes the ball away. And we'll see a picture of that in a second. We also see the one-ball payouts, like from Bally, where they have the huge console cabinets that go right to the floor. That's, you know, like a design style you see coming in that wasn't really seen previously. Mills embedded a slot machine in the head of a game called 1-2-3. I'm not sure exactly why they decided to do that, but it was an interesting idea. Just take a standard slot machine mech and slap it in a pinball machine, and you've got a nice game to sell. Back boxes are now mostly full-sized. Not all of them are, but they're almost to the size of the pinball machines we know and love and you see on as an icon on everybody's business cards. They're almost like that now. Some features, there was jackpot features as well, also called reserves, big bank nights, Bally Reserve, games like that had features that had big jackpots to pay out, not scoring jackpots, cash jackpots. Here we see Zeta. It was kind of an odd game in a floor-length console, and as you can see, the play field is just a circular play field with, I think, 10 holes, and the pop bumper in the middle. This is the game I own. I haven't found anybody else who's got a Zeta, although I'm sure they do exist, but until somebody comes forward, that's the oldest pop bumper in the world on the screen. And it does work, and the play field is metal, and the metal play field is part of the circuit to close the switch. So it's like the ball contacting the play field, contacting the bumper, closes the circuit, and causes it to kick. One other point about the Zeta is that when it came out in the middle of 38, Ted Stoner was in the hospital and actually died of appendicitis. And I think he had one of these in his hospital room when he died. So there you go. Here's one of the electromagnet games, Lightning. This example is from Dennis Dodell, who recently sold his game. And I think there might be a YouTube video on that, so you can see the electromagnets at work on the game. And they pulsed, apparently they pulsed on and off continuously throughout the life of the game. It wasn't like they were ever totally on or totally off. They're always just there. And you can see why a feature like that couldn't use batteries, because it would just drain them too fast. 1939, we see Bally creating a lot of games that have great Art Deco styling. I'm not sure they were the most interesting games to play necessarily, but they sure look great, and they're just really beautiful. At the same time, Exhibit was making games which I think had a lot of innovations. And so when I look back over the games created in 1937 to 39, I find that Exhibit probably had the most interesting games of all. And they had guys named Harry Williams and Lynn Durant there working together, and maybe that had something to do with it. Bumpers are still there, but they're sort of trending to plastic and rubber. They're still not really standardized the way we know them, but they're getting that way. They're no longer just strictly spring bumpers like the Bally bumper game. We see Exhibit creating games with kick-out holes, which kind of disappeared for a while, but now they're coming back. We see the first game that has the term special when lit on it, as noted on this cap here, special when lit, available from Pinball Classics. There you are, great hat, by our lovely model here. The war drums were beating, World War II's kind of looming, and it's kicking off in Europe, but I don't think there was a lot of effect on the industry, not in 1939. They were still kind of going full speed ahead. You start to see some war themes coming out, but it's not really in full swing yet. Exhibit created some games that used those Christmas tree lights, or they called them Wonder Stars, and they were used on Contact, Avalon, and Airliner. Interesting concept. So here we see some of these Art Deco style games. This is Bally Pick'em on the left, and a Bally Supreme backlash on the right. You see the beautiful designs, the Art Deco styling, the gusher and everything, the cool cars of the time. These are just nice examples of the style. More examples, we have Bally Variety and the playfields here from Vogue and Scoop. And you'll notice these games are just strictly bumpers. It's kind of like there's a pattern. We could just call this the bumper pattern of games. And there were so many games created in the late 30s and early 40s that just kind of look like that. You could almost close one eye and you can recognize the pattern. You've got 12 to 15 bumpers, possibly some rollovers, and not much else on the playfield. Not to say they weren't fun to play at that time, but I know, you know, today's audience doesn't really excite people too much, but there were a lot of games created with that pattern back then. And here we just see the nice back glasses from the Bally Scoop and Vogue games on the left, and the playfield from the Bally Double Feature. If you see in the middle there, it says Special One Lit, and I think that's the first game that had used that terminology, which became kind of, you know, synonymous with pinball. Just briefly to talk about the 40s period up to the war, the bumpers are still dominating the playfield. They're mostly plastic now and looking more like the standard bumpers we saw for, you know, the next 30 or 40 years, or even almost like the ones today. We see the war theme starting to appear in games as the war kicks off, especially after Pearl Harbor in late 1941. But game production pretty well is done by April 30th, 42. You know, nobody's allowed to make games anymore, new games at least. But we start to see conversion kits and games coming up, you know, made out of recycled parts from games they bring back in and melt down the solder or do whatever, or maybe just retheme a game by coming out with a new back glass with a war theme. As I say here, you know, Victory Games had a whole series of games that we can just politely say doing stuff to Japanese people. It wasn't very nice, I guess, but at the time it was the way it was. Manufacturers, you know, we probably heard, started to cut over into government war contracts, you know, parachute harnesses, radio parts, all sorts of different things to help the war. They had great factories set up that, and, you know, all the tooling in place to be able to quickly convert to do this sort of work. And they, you know, they benefited the country quite a bit with that. We see United Manufacturing and then Williams starting up, making conversion games. And that's how they got going in that time period. Just to want to talk about some of the trends in the 30s that were going on, you know, at the same time as the games are being built. One thing that interested me was this thing called Sportlands, which, you know, when I first heard about them, I'd go and Google on the internet and I wouldn't find anything. So that's when I started to look into it a bit more. These are basically the precursors of a redemption center, the Chuck E. Cheese's of the 30s, I guess. They were big. You'd get prizes for getting high scores. Typically, the Sportland would have, you know, the merchandise that you could win would be lining the walls of the arcade. And these prizes are targeted at adults, not children. So instead of stuffed animals and Nintendo games, you're getting exciting stuff like dishes and lamps, radios, cigarettes, and what are generally called premiums. There were companies that were in business to strictly sell this type of stuff. They had big catalogs of stuff you could buy, and the arcades would stock them and actually put them on the upper shelves above the game. So you're playing the game there, and you can look up and see what prize you could win with a good score. The ticket dispensing games that really started to come out in 1935, I think, were created for this purpose, to get around the cash payout problems. But you still get a record of what you've won, and then you can trade in those tickets for the prizes. Or places even maintained their own books. I guess if you had a game that was a pure novelty game, they could still record your scores manually, etc. Again, the problem with Sportlands is it's kind of caught the eye of the local constabularies, and is it gambling, and, you know, are people wasting their money on this, blah, blah, blah. Here's just a photo of a Sportland in New York City. They're all huddled around trying to win money. There might be a high prize for the high score of the day or the high score of the week. Maybe they can win a new pair of shoes or something like that. It sounds kind of mundane now, but it was pretty valuable back then. Back in the 30s, in the Depression period, you know, money wasn't so so prevalent everywhere, so people needed the basics of life. Another trend in the 30s that sort of tied into pinball a bit, because we saw some games created with themes related to it, is bank nights. This is another subject, if you Google, you don't really find a lot of information, but I think this was kind of a big phenomena, mostly in the 30s. The bank night system was really a franchise system started by a man called Charles Yeager in Colorado, maybe I think around 1931. The principle was that they would hand out tickets to theaters. You wouldn't have to have admission to the theater. You could just get a ticket and hang around outside. And at some point at either intermission or the end of the night, they'd have a draw for the winner. And if you had the winning ticket, you could get the jackpot. This kind of peaked in the mid-30s. But, of course, with cash payouts, fraud is a problem because theater owners and people could collude. And there was a case with a little girl called Goldilocks. She'd come up and pick the winning ticket, but she'd have palmed the insider's ticket in her hand and hand that over, and somebody would pretend they won, and the theater would pay out, but really they were just paying it to somebody they were in cahoots with. So lots of things like that going on. There are also problems with, they'd say if you won and you're out milling around outside, you had 3 minutes to get up to the front and claim your ticket, but you had to fight through 25,000 people, so the odds were against you even doing that, and if you didn't win, they just increased the jackpot for next week. You'd see big problems with huge crowds milling around outside, people who didn't buy tickets to the theater waiting to see if they'd won, and, you know, causing disturbances on the streets and impeding people who just wanted to walk down the street or whatever, occasionally angry mobs and all that nastiness. Pinball games, Rockola came out with a game called Big Bank Night in 1936. There's also a Giant Movie Bank game in 1936. These are reflecting the culture, the world around them. And that's interesting to see. I mentioned earlier in 1938, there were games came out, had a big bank night feature. And again, that's just to mirror what was going on in the real world. Here we see Charles Yeager, the happy man, because he's making millions of dollars franchising this system. See some advertising at the top right there where there was like a jackpot of $850. He'd just send a vehicle around town and probably a loudspeaker to tell everybody to show up at the theater. And at the bottom, you can see they all showed up at the theater, thousands of them milling around. And, you know, again, you can imagine if somebody at the back there won and they had 3 minutes to get inside and claim their ticket to win, how difficult that could be. Lots of lawsuits and stuff. In 1936, we saw the prevalence of the coin-operated skee-ball game. Skee-ball was an old game, but the thought of making it a coin-operated game was kind of new. Wurlitzer bought the rights from the National Skee-Ball Company in 1936, and Paul Fuller, who later designed the famous Wurlitzer 1015 jukebox, the design of it, he restyled the game and made it a lot more attractive. And suddenly there was an explosion in coin-op, bowling and skee-ball games in that time period. Games, of course, are big and heavy to move, but fun. And, we see that although the fad kind of died out then a bit, skee-ball still lives today. So it really had some legs. Here we see top left a Genko bankroll, and up top right a Bally roll game on location. You can see they take up a lot of space, and they're pretty heavy. They typically weigh 450 or 500 pounds. Real backbreakers. The bottom, this is from a Wurlitzer advertising brochure. Basically, this is like a Sportland, but with Wurlitzer skee ball games. And you can see the merchandise up top. On the left, there's dishes. In the middle, you've got bunny rabbits and other stuffed animals. And on the right, I think you got lamps and radios as prizes. So you're playing the game, and you got that carrot on the stick right in front of your eyes, what you can win for doing well. There are also some trends related to shooting games. The Seberg Rayolite games, based on optical electronics, they kind of started appearing in 1936, and a lot of games came out with using that principle. Shooting games are kind of the perfect game format for World War II, because you can, shoot at destroyers and shoot at airplanes and whatever. You get games like Aerator and Skyfighter, Defender. Some of them are not based on optical electronics. You just have the discs, as we saw in the 1950s shooting games, but this is when they really started to take off, late 30s, early 40s, right before the war. Other games in that period that were popular too, bowling. You see like the Evans 10 Strike and the Bally Alley games, you know, 10 Strike being a mannequin bowler and Bally Alley with an interesting mechanism. So these are other things that are going on at the same time as pinball is becoming popular. You know, it isn't just strictly pinball. There's other things happening in the coin-op industry. And, you know, they're all competing or complementing each other, I guess, depending on the situation. There's just a flyer for Defender. Neat-looking games. This is a row of the Mutascope Skyfighter games installed. Very cool-looking games. I'd like to get one of these games, but they're typically 8 feet high and really hard to get in your basement. So we'll just briefly move on and talk about the people behind the games. We've talked about the evolution of the games and some of the cultural tie-ins and other competing and complementary amusements, but at the heart of it are the people. Some of the most famous or fundamental founders of the industry, we have Harry Williams, who started out on the West Coast with Allied Amusements, later came over and all the way worked for other companies. He co-founded United with Lynn Durant, and then, of course, Williams Electronics or Williams Manufacturing at the time. Ray Maloney with Lion and Bally. David Gottlieb for D. Gottlieb and Company. David Rockola for the Rockola Company. And Jimmy Johnson, Wayne Nyan's old boss at Western. And I'll put a plug in here for a man called Ed Guida has come out with a book, Just for Fun, Jimmy Johnson's Playland Park. Ed worked for Jimmy, and this book is mostly concentrated on Jimmy Johnson's career, if you want to call it that, with a San Antonio amusement park, but there is some great shots in there of Western in the 30s. So here you see some pictures of these people. Ray Maloney, he started with Lion, which was actually a printing shop in Chicago in 1928. He was a sales manager, got promoted to being a general manager when they started selling punch boards. And then in 1931, they came out with Ballyhoo, and Ray took control, and they were making 300 to 500 Ballyhoos a day and sold 50,000 overall. And that kind of kicked off, you know, it was one of the main games that helped kick off the industry, and certainly Bally. And Ray had purchased the company wholly, 100%, by 1940. I didn't actually know that he didn't own the company right off the bat, but it took him a while to actually get full control. David Gottlieb started out selling hand grip games and punch boards, I think, in Texas before moving to Chicago. And, you know, they created a couple of games before Baffle Ball, but Baffle Ball was a huge seller. And then they come out with a string of hits in, 1932, and were on their way. David Rockola, of course, I guess they're most famous for jukeboxes, but Rockola created some, as we talked about, some of the really classic games of the 30s, like World Series and Army Navy, World's Fair Jigsaw. But they were pretty much out of pinball by the late 30s. Jimmy Johnson of Western, again, buy Ed Guida's book, and you can read lots of stuff about him. And ask Wayne Nyans, just ask him to tell you any story about Jimmy Johnson. He's got a pile for you. And they're all interesting, I guarantee you. Harry Williams, that photo there is from 1934. He had a long career in design, and he was really a genius when it came to creating new and unique things. We can talk more about him later. Fred McClellan was the founder of PAMCO, or Pacific Amusement, on the West Coast. They created the contact game with Harry in-house. Fred was a carburetor manufacturer, also owned car dealerships in Idaho and California before getting into the coin-op industry. And after PAMCO stopped making games around 1939, he was still involved, I think, up in Sacramento selling coin-op games. Al Douglas, you don't hear too much about him, but he was one of the co-founders of DeVal, who made a lot of wonderful games from, I think, 1934 to 39. He's the Al and DeVal, the other, the Dav or Dave is Dave Helfenbein. Ted Stoner, we talked about, died in 1938. He was one of the colorful principals of the Stoner Company. He was an airline pilot, and there's a few photos of him flying games out to distributors on his airplane, strapped to the wing or whatever. Too bad he had to pass away so young. I think he was only 34. His brother Harry at lower right was the other brother who ran Stoner. And Harry is probably most famous for some stuff long after the pinball years. Stoner created pinball games up to the start of World War II. But after the war, they concentrated on their candy vending games, beautiful candy vending games. My wife should be paying attention because we saw a beautiful candy vending game I'd like to buy when I go home. But he was most famous. He got rid of the company in 1959, and he sold out to Vendo, and he signed a five-year deal to work for them and a 10-year non-competition contract so he wouldn't compete against them. But he didn't like the way they treated him at Vendo. And by 1964, when his contract expired, he went on to work with some people he'd helped start up in a company called Electrovend, and Vendo came back and sued them. And this case is pretty famous. So if anybody's ever signed a contract that says, I'm not going to compete against this company when I leave, the case with Harry Stoner is often cited. Because that court case, when it started in 1965, I was in kindergarten. By the time that case was resolved, I'd graduated from university. You know, it was like, I think it was 17 years in the courts, and lots of legal precedent set back and forth. And basically, I think Harry lost, and he was dead by the time it was over anyway. So his wife had to absorb whatever fines were doled out. Lynn Durant was Harry Williams' partner and founded United. He's Steve Kordick told some stories about him. He was kind of a famous playboy guy in the 50s, flamboyant, but also, I think, a pretty skilled engineering type. Harry and Lynn made a dynamic duo at Exhibit from about 1938 onwards. And as I pointed out earlier, I seem to, when I look at the games, I think Exhibit's games were amongst the most original and creative in that time period. And I think these two guys were key behind it. We can't often attribute every game and every feature to individual people that far back, but it looks like they had a hand in a lot of it. And at top right, we see Walter Tratch, who was the T in ABT. ABT made some pinball games and some interesting coin-op games in the 30s, although they were really kind of out of pinball by the late 30s. But of course, ABT is most famous for their coin mechs or coin slides at the time, which were used very heavily by the manufacturers. Walter was, I think, a machinist by nature, and you know, he got his start in little machine shops in Kentucky in 1923, I think I saw a picture of. So then we get on to the guys who actually do the work, and we've got a couple in the room. Or at least Wayne is here. I don't know if Steve Kordick's here, but Wayne is here. Wayne from 1936 onwards, Western Manufacturing from 36 to 39, and then on to Gottlieb. He was there when Harry Mabbs created the flipper. And after Harry left, Wayne took over all the design duties at Gottlieb from, approximately 1949 to 65. And we all know all those games because I think we all own them. And what a wonderful guy all the way around, not just for his design skills. Steve Kordick started at Genco in 1937. And he joined an interesting fellow, Harvey Heiss. And they worked on games and designed games for, two decades together. Harvey was a fixture at Expo back in the early days. He was always great. Rob knows a lot about his stories. He was always up here telling some great stories and getting the house laughing really good. And Harvey was a very skilled man making castings and a lot of interesting games out of Genco that were different from other manufacturers at that time. Harry Williams, we've talked about. I mean, he worked at Allied Amusements, Pamco, Rockola for a while. He had a hand in the famous 1937 World Series games, Exhibit, United, Williams, and then later on even at Stern Electronics around the 1980 period, still designing games up until his death in 83. and Lynn Durant, we've talked about, and there's just a lot of other people. It's hard to, again, it's hard to track all these people. There's, you know, there's so many of them, and they often weren't recognized like designers are today. They didn't put their names on the playfield or anything like that. They were just kind of hidden in a back room. And here we see some photos of these gentlemen. You'll note at top right, Herb Breitenstein. He was with Coincraft, and then at Western for a while, and then on to Bally, and we'll talk about him some more later. He was a pretty accomplished guy. Here we see Harvey Heiss. Those two Harvey Heiss photos were taken at Expo 88. You can see a bit of the baby in the whole game at left. Rob's brought the electronic version that was built, sort of inspired by that game that Harvey had built in his spare time. Some references for further information. I have a couple of websites, 1930s.com and coinopimages.com, lots of photos and stories there, books for sale. IPDB.org that Jay has been really running with the last few years. He's collecting lots of information on all the games, not just 30s games. Wayne Namro's got pinballhistory.org site, so always got lots of good information there. There's a pre-war group at yahoo.com and the website Pre-War Pinball. That was set up by Ken Lyons. If you've got 30s games, that's a good place to go and ask questions. You can ask questions on Rec Games Pinball as well, but a lot of these people spend most of their time at that news group instead. As I mentioned before, Dick Bouchel's Encyclopedias of Pinball are very interesting. Lots of color flyer reproductions, lots of great information. Dick interviewed a lot of these people in the 70s, back when they were still alive, when no one else thought to do that. So he's got a lot of information in there you won't find anywhere else. I've printed the pinball ad catalogs I talked about earlier. I've got Volume 3, which is brand new, out for sale at Mark Wayne's booth in the exhibit hall. And Michael Shaloub's produced some great books where he's got lots of interviews and information directly from Wayne and Steve Kordick and others. And you can get, you know, the first-person accounts of what happened and lots of good photos, information there, and lots of great shots of games as well. Okay, I want to talk about Mr. X. Who am I? This is a guy I've been researching for a couple of years, and I don't think people know really too much the full extent of who this guy is. So I just thought it'd be fun to go through and talk about him. To me, he's one of the most interesting people to ever work in the pinball industry. Doesn't mean he did the most in the pinball industry, but of the people who did work in the industry, I think his life was probably one of the most interesting. He's a Canadian-born pinball and coin-op game designer, just like this guy. Anybody know? John Papaduk? No. All right, we'll save that for the next. All right, next one, next clue. He has 8 pinball and coin-op patents to his credit. He drove in the Indianapolis 500, and he was Canadian dirt track champion. Canadian-born pinball designer, 8 patents, drove in the Indy 500. He promoted races at the most famous racetracks around the country. Yeah. Founded a famous stunt flying group that was written up in many books, magazine articles, and newspaper stories. Anybody? No. He and his friends took part in the most expensive movie ever made at that time. No. His first name is Ronald. Canadian pinball designer, drove in the Indianapolis 500, first name Ronald. Okay, next. Second name Griffith. No? Okay, Mr. X. Anybody recognize him? Sorry, these photos aren't the greatest. No? Okay, next screen. Da 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 da. Bon McDougall! Bon McDougall! Ronald Griffith Bon McDougall, born in Winnipeg, Manitoba. His father was a minister. He was kicked out of the army in World War I for enlisting underaged. Made his way to Los Angeles, bought a war surplus airplane, a Curtis Jenny, and gave air lessons at the Burdett Airport in Los Angeles to people. And there he is, our man Bon. He was the founder of the 13 Black Cats of Hollywood, along with Fronty Nichols and Spider Matlock. And the members of this group, they had most of them had 13 letters in their names. If the names didn't have 13 letters, they'd make it work out, so it did. So I think that's how Bond got his nickname, so that Bond McDougal would add up to 13 letters. This group included a lot of famous stunt aviators and barnstormers and motion picture pilots within this group. Here we see Bond, future pinball designer, flying as Curtis Jenny with three guys risking their lives on the wings doing some barnstorming. Bond always flew with the number 13 on the tail, and although it's hard to see, he has a black cat there, which he made up some hubbub about where it came from, but that was sort of his, you know, his signature calling card. And that's how the group got named. Frank Lockhart, another one of the black cats, he won the Indianapolis 500, but he died setting a land speed record in 1928. Another one of them was Art Goebel, who won the Dole Air Race from Oakland to Hawaii in 1927, collected a big cash prize, but I think 10 people died trying to collect on that, and only two planes made it to Hawaii. Another one of the black cats was, at least honorary, was Reginald Denny, who was a World War I war hero and actor. Also, Paul Richter and Jack Fry, who went on to be founders of TWA Airlines and partners with Howard Hughes. Frank Clark, who is probably the most famous movie stunt pilot, was with the group. Here's one of the often published photos. Bond is the second guy from left standing in the back row. Art Goebel's beside him and some of the other black cats. I always like the cool designs on these shirts. Spider Matlock, he tempted his fate a lot, and I think he used up his nine lives pretty fast. He was killed in a car accident at Ascot Speedway in 1936. Bond drove a Miller car at the 1926 Indy 500. He qualified nine, but he only did 19 laps. He went out with a broken water pump. He raced a lot at the Legion Ascot Speedway in Los Angeles and promoted races there for a while. Claimed to have had a fractured skull and a broken leg in a race in Abilene, Texas. And he also made some other claims. However, in checking with some of the auto racing historians, they can't be substantiated. So we kind of wonder if Bond was just really pulling wool over people's eyes. But some of it's true, so it's hard to figure out what was true and what wasn't. Here we see Bond in his race car at the Indy 500 getting ready to go. It's a Miller 122 model, I think. 1926 at the Speedway. Coin-op-wise, Bond hooked up with Fred McClellan through his auto racing endeavor, or his car, or auto dealership endeavor, I believe. Bond joined Pamco in 1934. He took over the Major League game that Harry Williams had started and brought that to market, and he's credited with designs for Pamco Parlay, Bally Derby, Allied Barrel Roll, and possibly a couple of others. I know he worked on some like arcade games like Pamco's Ball Game in 1937, Bally Arcade was a game in 1938, and some others. And some of his patents go through to 1939. Here we see Bond second from right in front of a Pamco Marksman, like a rail light shooting game. Fred McClellan's to the left of him. Another Pamco guy, Ken Willis, is on the right, and that's a distributor on the left. There are many good photos of Bond, a lot of them because he's a pilot and stunt flyer. He's always wearing his cap or his helmet, so it's hard to get good shots of him. Bond was with Pamco until 1937. He eventually moved to Bally. He may have done some work there before then, based on his credit for Bally Derby, but he was definitely with Pamco until 37. Joined Bally, worked on some arcade games there. Joined Douglas Aircraft. At the time, they were increasing their manpower for World War II. I mean, they hired hundreds of thousands of people to build aircraft. Douglas got its start at Cloverfield in Santa Monica, where Bond and his friends stunted. And he worked at Douglas for 25 years and died in 1970. Here we see just a couple of the advertising flyers that left the Cloverfield flyers, a big poster where they were flying out of Santa Monica. Lots of them there, it's hard to read their names. Bond's the one at lower left on the wing. A lot of the black cats listed there too, just out, you know, doing their stunts, wing walking and spectacular things, parachute jumps, plane-to-plane transfers, etc. And on the auto racing side, you see the ad right in a newspaper, you know, Auto Races at Ventura Fairgrounds, five events, Stapp, McDougall, and others. The Stapp is Babe Stapp, who raced at Indianapolis 13 times. World's greatest dirt track drivers. That might be Bond's words about himself. Maybe nobody else agreed with him, though. And the thing that I find exciting about Bond is that his life as a pinball and coin-op game designer was only about the third or fourth most interesting thing he did in his life. You know, a lot of us would be so happy as to have this as a career, and yet this is he did two other things that were even, you know, more exciting perhaps and written up in. And just as a final thing, he also owned a gold mine in Arizona, but he sold it to fly with the Mexican Federal Army to put down the Escobar Revolution in 1929, or so claimed Bond. No evidence that he did that, but there were some U.S. pilots who did fly. In fact, there was one who flew, his name was Patrick Murphy. He was supposed to fly and bomb the revolutionaries, but he was supposed to bomb a place called Naco in Mexico, but there was a Naco in Arizona, and he bombed that one instead. So the first air attack in the U.S., I think, was by this one-legged drunken American guy. Anyway, all right, next. And to me, again, the thing about Bond McDougall is I call him the hobby generator. You look at Bond in the center, and I just made up this graph of all the things he was involved in, all the things I've had to research about him, and they're all interesting in and of themselves. So if you're bored and you get tired of pinball, you know, just pick a line in the graph and follow it. It goes on forever. And that's it. We got any time for questions or not? Any questions? Dave?
Square circle games from 32, what was the play field slope on those? Is it conical or?
Oh, I think it's Dave asked what's the shape of the play field in the circle square games. I think they're bowl shaped. Anything else? Well, thanks a lot.